As Harry mentioned, I come here at more as someone with over 20 years of experience as a practicing actuary in the life insurance industry, both in Canada and the United States. During that time, we've seen the evolution of capital requirements for essentially all financial institutions. I had experience in the 80s where essentially before we had capital requirements of basically any kind. And as most of you are aware, the savings and loans problem in the United States developed there largely due to a lack of capital requirements, because it put businesses in a position where you could essentially adopt a very risky business strategy, roll the dice, and if you won, well, you got to keep the winnings, and if you lost, well, you just handed the problem to a regulator. And I think everyone agreed that when capital requirements first came in a little over a decade ago, that they went a long way to at least solving that problem. However, we're now moving much a long way down the path, and we're just getting much more sophisticated about the game. So the work that I'm actually going to be describing today is motivated and largely by capital issues. And I'm going to go, I'll have a fair number of slides where I just give that background on the assumption that you haven't had the same kind of 20-odd years worth of experience in the industry that I've had. I'll then turn to actually some relatively theoretical results, which are things that I've come across recently while thinking about all of these issues on capital requirements. Most of them I'll take credit for discovering on my own. Then as my knowledge of the risk literature increases, I suddenly discover, oh, someone else already got there first. But on the other hand, I do think hopefully you'll find the things that I'm pulling together here today are interesting things to pull together, even if they aren't totally original. I will then give some simple examples of the actual risk measure that I'm going to propose. I'm actually going to come up with a definition of what I call a tail covariance that I think is both that is interesting and useful. I'll give some examples, and then I'll finally give some indication of where the work is going. It's far from a complete work. What you're going to see today is one step in something that's very much a work in progress. So the primary issue that motivated the work that you're going to see today is essentially one of understanding capital for, in this case, insurance entities. Just a little bit background. We've had a regulatory standard of capital for insurance companies in Canada for a little over 10 years. It's called Minimum Continuing Capital and Surplus Requirement, or MCCSR, so one of our insurance industry acronyms. It's what I call a factor-based formula, and by that I mean you essentially look at the inventory of all the items on the asset or liability side of your balance sheet, and you look at every item, you go through some risk assessment on that, and you apply a factor times the size of that element, and then you then add that up. At a high level, there are essentially four broad categories of risk that the insurance formula looks at. There's obviously credit risk or default risk is a major one, and essentially you go through every bond and based on whether it's a highly rated bond or a low rated bond, you apply a little factor or a big factor to it. It's that simple. We also tend to be concerned about something we call insurance pricing risk, which is essentially the risk that the premiums we're charging turn out to be inadequate for the insurance losses that we're crediting. Another risk for a financial institution, especially life insurers who have relatively long liabilities, is that there's an asset liability risk here. If you seriously mismatch your liabilities, well, that can either work for you or against you. And again, these are factor-based approximations. And then finally, what we call the C4 risk, which is 10 years ago, we just call it other. I think we probably call it today. We call that operational risk. But essentially, all of those ideas have been in place for the better part of 10 years. In Canada, once we develop these component risks, we simply do a very simple thing. We just add them up. But that's obviously a very practical thing to do, but that's one of the things that everyone kind of sort of says, well, hey, that's really not the right way to do it. There ought to be some kind of an interaction between the risks. And in the United States, where they went through a very similar process of developing factor-based formulas. Again, they had different factors, but they had the same underlying principles. And they came along and they basically said, well, gee, we think the C2, which is the interest pricing risk, is essentially independent. Oh, sorry, there should be a plus sign in here. My apologies there. It's essentially independent of the investment and the credit risk and the asset liability management risk. So at a very high level, they said I've got one risk, which is I've got two risks that are perfectly correlated and one risk that's independent of the other two. So that kind of justifies this square root calculation. Again, it's very high level. You know, everyone basically realizes it's a very simplistic thing, but again, it's far better than having no capital formula at all. So here we are, we're kind of coming down the path. We've had all of these systems in place for about 10 years, and again, as I said, we're all far better off with them today than we were with no capital requirement at all. Well, what's kind of new today that would cause one to want to go back and kind of revisit all of this? One of the motivating factors is that the insurance industry is anticipating a move to a totally new accounting system. This is what's currently referred to as an international accounting system that was originally developed largely in Europe, where they have many different countries with many different accounting systems, and they simply said we just simply have to have one uniform standard that applies across the European Union, and they have set 2005 as being the target date for when that has to come in. And if they're going to go to all that trouble, they're now essentially inviting the rest of the world to kind of join in and go along with them. And certainly Canada has given the indication that it's going to go there, although exactly when is another question. It may not be 2005. But what that new system is, for insurance at least, it's essentially a market value-based system for assets and liabilities, which is quite different from where we are now, where we essentially have what I call a book value-based valuation system. That's something new that's coming down the pike, and if we go to a totally new accounting system, then we're going to have essentially a new supporting capital system to go with it. I guess the other thing that's happened in the last 10 years is that we've had significant developments in what I would simply call the science of risk. An example would, of course, be the classic 1997 paper by our previous speaker with a number of others developing this whole idea of a coherent risk measure. And say we have now, as we just saw in the previous presentation, we have very solid results on single-period risks, and perhaps we're still wondering about what the right thing to do is on the multi-period risk. A third development here is the whole idea of what I would call an internal model. Everyone recognizes that any kind of factor-based formula has to be a highly simplistic thing. If I'm simply going to say that all AA rated bonds are the same, that's a simplification. It's necessary as a practical matter. But the only real way to get a handle on many of these complicated risks and all their interactions is to actually go and build an appropriate stochastic model of the company and then base your analysis on the results of that model. We're heading into a world where that kind of modeling exercise is going to be accepted. I mean, I think 10 years ago, I don't think anybody would have dreamed that kind of modeling exercise would ever be credible to a regulator. Well, we're now getting to the point in both banking and insurance where we're starting. I don't say we're there, certainly in everything, but we're heading in that direction. And I guess I've already mentioned one of the big drivers behind this development that I'm talking about here is the International Actuarial Association, which is essentially trying to develop a capital model that will be consistent with the new accounting model when it comes down. And say my firm is heavily involved in that effort, as are a number of other, quite a few Canadians in the insurance industry. In fact, both Harry Panger and Dr. Brender, who's now the federal regulator here in Canada, are also involved in a working party whose task is to develop a risk-based capital process that makes sense in this new world. Now, having said all that, we're going to have all these wonderful things. my particular angle on this is to come back and sort of say, well, even if we have all these wonderful new models, we're still going to need what I call factor-based models. Even they may be based on internal models, but invariably internal models turn out to be complicated and they're difficult to use and they're a bit of a sledgehammer and you don't always need them to kill a fly. Even when you have a big complicated model, invariably you need to have some simple rule of thumb to let you know when after you've run your model for 2 or 3 hours and a number comes out and you have the marvelous problem sitting back saying, well, do you believe it? That's the kind of practical problem I face every day, and part of obviously being a professional is knowing when you see a dumb number. And these more simple models that I'm going to be talking about in a moment are essentially, in part, going to be based on things, simpler calculations you can do that help you assess whether or not you've got a reasonable result from a complicated model. So I basically asked myself the problem, what really is the best way to develop a formula approximation to a complex risk measure? As I said, we may yet be debating exactly which risk measure we should be looking at, but whatever it is, I can assure you we're going to want to have some kind of simple approximation to how it behaves. Obviously, I want a level of simplicity. I don't want it to be any more complicated than the factor-based formulas that I currently have, which are actually quite complex if anyone here has ever had to actually fill one of those forms out. You want it to be flexible enough that it will apply in a wide range of practical situations, that it will work in one company that does this kind of business and work just as well in another company that does a different kind of business in that industry. And obviously, and finally, you want it to actually be reasonably accurate, that it actually would reproduce the results of the complicated model, assuming you went to the time and expense to build it and run it. So I'm not going to try and sort of solve that problem today, but I'm simply saying that's the problem that I've got in the back of my mind, and one of the simplest kind of proxies for that is to simply imagine that I have a number of different sources of loss, and my total loss is simply the sum of all that. I'm going to define a term that I'm going to use here, something as an exposure, meaning the mean of each of those losses. If you want to have something concrete, just imagine these are different, say, lines of property and casualty insurance, that X1 is my fire insurance line, and X2 is my automobile insurance line, and X3 is something else. That'd be a nice one. So some measure, I want to have some way of knowing how much fire insurance I have, how much house insurance I have, whatever. So if I'm taking the mean of that loss is simply one way of articulating that, but it's not the only measure I could use. So having defined that, I'm now going to define another random variable I call U here, which is simply the balancing item. So if E is the mean, then obviously U is a unitized risk because it has a mean of 1. And having said that, and I'm going to define all the other parameters that govern the joint distribution of my unitized risks, I'm going to call those shape parameters. So if I now come along, someone now comes along and gives me some coherent risk measure, so here's my risk, and I adopt a coherent risk measure, and Harry Panger showed a number of years ago, all coherent risk measures have a representation of the, essentially as a distorted mean, then what I'm going to think of that risk as being a function of my exposure and my shape parameters. So that's all I can, having defined, I've simply got a concept here of exposure parameters, I've got shape parameters. Why do I want to do that? I have one reason, because as I want a formula, ultimately, that allows me to deal with the fact that as I go from one company to another, or year, one day to another, my exposures are going to change. But actually, in a large number of cases, my shape parameters often don't. And if you imagine a portfolio of investment risks, as I simply scale up or down my exposure to a given asset class, as long as my position in the market actually isn't affecting the risk itself, that's something that actually happens. So this is a useful model problem to look at, and it's a reasonable model for a portfolio of what I call investment risks. It's less. It doesn't apply quite so nicely to a pure portfolio of insurance risks. But the main thing that this function has, though, because of the scaling property, if I scale all my exposures now, and this is true for any coherent measure, if I scale all my exposures, leaving my shape parameters unchanged, all that does is it just scales up my risk measure. And that's a property that's relatively easy to verify. You can verify that, and it's essentially, it actually is one of the properties of being a coherent risk measure. It has to scale properly when you have positive positive scaling factors. So another way, so the conclusion of that is this risk measure is a homogeneous function of degree one in the exposure parameters. That has some very important consequences. The first thing you can do is when you write that expression down, you can differentiate it with respect to that scaling parameter lambda. And the first thing you get is an expression which is a well-known property of homogeneous functions. But in this case, it actually tells you something useful because it shows you how you can take your total capital here, which is the function C, and this actually gives you what I call this thing on the left. I call that an allocation, which basically shows you if you want to now take that total capital, which depends on the interaction of all the risks, and then allocate it back to the individual components. Well, here's a way to do it. And there's a second consequence, which is more technical. I'm not going to dwell on that, which again just comes from different. It says this matrix of second derivatives here turns out to be degenerate because obviously there's a non-zero vector here that it annihilates. So my problem now is essentially if I know what my capital is for some target company and I want to sort of say, okay, how does that vary as I change my company a little bit, or put another way, if I know what my capital is here for a given portfolio of risks, how does that change as I consider modifications? You know, say a year from now, my portfolio risk might be a little bit different, or it might be my actual company might be a little bit different from the one that I built this model of, which very will be. So I want to know understand how this capital function kind of behaves for in a neighborhood of some particular point. So I essentially ask the question, what is the analog for homogeneous functions of something like a Taylor expansion? Taylor expansions don't work for you in this case because they do not preserve homogeneity. That's why you can't really use them. You can, but they aren't very convenient. But essentially my problem is I want to start off here. I've got a target point here, and I've gone to a lot of effort to somehow evaluate both the value of my function at that point and its first two derivatives. Can I then go and build some kind of appropriate approximating function? And here's a technical result, which again, my guess is it isn't new, but I haven't seen this particular result. When you ask for homogeneous functions that agree up to second order with your existing function, what you find is that there isn't just one. In fact, there are infinitely many. So we're inundated with riches here, and in particular, start with any vector here, which I call R sub I, as long as it satisfies this little constraint here, being such that then for that vector R sub I, for any such vector, as long as it satisfies that initial constraint, I can build this whole family of functions, which are both homogeneous and which agree with my capital function to second order. At the particular point at which I then. So this is a candidate for a formula approximation. If I can figure out how to get my hands on these derivatives, then I've got something that I can use or can take as a reasonable proxy for how this capital is going to behave in a neighborhood of my point. So Yeah, C0 was the value of the function at the target point where actually I build my big complicated model and it tells me what the answer is at that one point. And somehow, so C0 is the value at that point, then you got first derivatives and second, all the information you would typically use in just a second-order Taylor expansion. Except I'm not going to use a second-order Taylor expansion, I'm going to use this guy down here. So up until now, we've just been working in very broad. This could have applied to any risk measure. Now I'm going to go to TailVar. Obviously, after having heard this talk today, I've got to change this the next time I give it. I don't know what I'm going to use, but TailVar turns out to have some very convenient properties when viewed from the perspective of this kind of analysis. Because if my risks are normal, there's some very standard results. The tail bar for a normal risk is just a simple function of the mean and the variance with this function, this funny factor here, which is simply a function of the level at which you're going to go into the tail. And again, I can write that expected value of my risk x is simply, in this case, it's the sum of the individual expectations of the individual risks, and my variance of x in this case is again a question of summing over the covariance of all of the elements of the interaction of the various sub-risks. And I notice that this is exactly the same form as my formula approximation. So I have a very nice result here that if in fact my risks were all normal, let's say all the components and obviously the sum, then the formula approximation I wrote down before with the, in this case with all my R vector equal to 1, would give a precise result. So this is, so my formula approximation is going to be good to some degree, obviously in some neighborhood of my initial point for any distribution of risks, but it will be exact in the case if my risks were actually all normal. And obviously the point, of course, we knew that, and the issue, of course, is dealing with all the non-normal risks. However, the normal example suggests that I'm going to define now basically a tail covariance, what I'm going to call the tail covariance. And the way I'm going to define the tail covariance is in such a way that my formula approximation here that we developed before, which we said is valid essentially for any risk, I'm going to simply define now the tail covariance to be up to this factor, basically this guy that was under the square root sign here. And essentially, what I've essentially done is essentially shown you that this is with this definition, and I'll restate it in a slightly more useful form in just a minute, but with that stroke, or the way we kind of backed into the definition, it's got two properties. One is that it agrees with normal covariance when all the risks are normal, which is a useful property. And secondly, it's going to be the right thing to work in this formula approximation, so I can, any intuitions I have about how tail var works with normal risks are now going to be essentially useful to me now as long as I use this tail covariance rather than the standard covariance. And that's fine as long as I can get a handle on these second derivatives, the first and second derivatives. And the thing that kind of makes all this quasi-reasonably practical is the following, there's a couple of results here. I'm not going to prove them here. But essentially what they tell you is that if you just have a large enough sample from your risk, you can actually estimate what these derivatives are without actually doing any differentiation. You don't actually have to tweak your model and run your sample all over again. You can deduce directly from one sample estimates of what these derivatives are. The first one says that this first derivative of the capital with respect to a change in exposure is simply the expected value of your unit risk, given that your total exceeds the quantile. I say that's not a new result. That's been around formally published just recently, but I think it's been known in the industry for about 2 years. The second one here, which is basically says the same, gives you a tool for estimating the matrix of second derivatives. I believe that's original to me, but you know, my knowledge of the literature may not be as good as some of the other people here in this room, because I'll say I'm just a practitioner, so what do I know? So the good news here is that if you can simulate these things, then you can actually develop approximations to these derivatives. So that now comes back, and I put all that back together, and I wind up with the following kind of summary of all these developments. What is it? Well, I've got this definition that I'm now going to say I'm going to define the tail covariance of these variables, which tail, again, it's a function of obviously the variables and the parameter, which alpha, which tells you how far into the tail you've gone. And what do I do? Well, I've got this funny factor here, which is 2 pi 1 minus, but essentially I now look at the following things. I look at the expected value of my value greater than its mean. This is not the tail mean. This is the real mean. So the excess of its mean over the mean, given that it exceeds the quantile, times the covariance, the standard covariance, but given that you're actually at the quantile. And the here fx, this is the probability density of the thing, which again assumes we have a continuous variable here. And there's a second term here, which is again looking at the product of the expectations of the marginal components, again over their means, again given that that the total exceeds the quantile. So I know that's a bit of a funny thing to look at, but rather than trying to look at that actual formula, the two, I'd like to emphasize how we got to that in the first place. And there are two properties that led us to that definition. One is I wanted something that will reduce to a standard covariance when all the risks are normal. And believe me, that's what you can convince yourself that it does that. And secondly, it's consistent with this, let's say, this formula approximation to tail var. So that, this, in a certain sense, that this definition here is kind of essentially my main result. Here, this is something that is useful, I claim, to look at if you're both working with tail var and you're interested in working with risks that perhaps aren't normal. Just as here's a very, very simple example. Let's suppose I take three risks which are individually are all Pareto risks. They all have unit mean and unit variance, and they're all independent. And as probably most of you know, the Pareto distribution has a parameter in it which basically governs the thickness of the tail. And in this particular example, I'm choosing a parameter which is, I've got essentially three heavy tail Pareto distributions is what I've got here. So the normal covariance, the standard covariance matrix here is just that. It's a standard, that's the way I've constructed the problem. They're all independent. They all have unit variance. And then I go and I draw a sample size, and this what I've actually done is drawn a 50,000 samples from this particular distribution, and I have gone and estimated all of the quantities that we looked at before. In particular, if you actually wanted to know at the 90% level, for example, what was the conditional tail expectation, well, it's actually the sum of these things, so it's a little over 6. And this would give you the allocation of each of that 6 back to the individual risks. Now, theoretically, all of these numbers should be the same, but that gives you just a little hint of how much sampling error there is in my sample of 50,000. It's not material. And here's what I'm calling the tail covariance here, which is this other fancy thing that I talked about before. But what's it telling us here? It's telling us that kind of when we get out into the tail, interestingly, the individual variances of the risks have gone down a little bit, not a lot, but they now look like they're a little more correlated in the tail, whereas before they were completely independent. Well, now they're actually this measure is suggesting that yes, they when we're actually out in the last in the 10% of the tail that they're a little bit correlated. And I'm going to just do a couple more simple examples, kind of like that. I think the next one, essentially, I do. What have I done? Okay, what I've done here is I've simply moved. I've gone from a 90% measure to a 95. So I've just gone further into the tail. But I've left the risks as otherwise. They're still independent. I've just gone further into the tail. And what you now see, this is done. It's now they're now looking. The individual risks now look a lot more volatile. These individual variances have gone up. The covariances, interestingly, I haven't changed all that much. I'd like to be able to say I can give very nice interpretations of exactly what all of this means, but a lot of this work is so new that I can't really. There are going to be a few things here that I still struggle with trying to understand intuitively. At a high level, this makes sense. The further we've gone into the tail, these things look more volatile and they become more correlated. This one, I've essentially gained the same three risks. Well, the only thing I've done here is instead of having them all the same, I've now taken a mixture of three risks. One is very heavy-tailed as it was before. It's got a shape parameter of 0.4. One's very light-tailed. It's got a negative shape parameter, which is just the opposite. And I've taken another one, which is kind of in the middle, essentially an exponential risk. And this is one, I guess this one surprised me because it kind of came back. I would have thought the heavy tail risk would have been the one that would show up being the guy that causes you the most difficulty. But the answer is no, it's not. It's the exponential risk. It turns out to be the one that you would allocate the most capital to here. And that's consistent also with what's going on the diagonal. It says here that the medium risk one, once you're in the tail, is the guy that's the most serious one, and I have to admit I don't fully understand exactly where this negative correlation is coming from. That's something I've yet to fully wrap my mind around. Again, this is still at the 95% level. I'll do one more here, again, just to kind of give a sense. And that what I've done in here is instead of having independent risks, I put them through a copula so that there's some natural correlation to begin with. So the risks really are correlated now, but I've otherwise left them the same. And what's happened now is that they look a lot more correlated than they were before. All of those tail correlation covariances have gone up substantially as a result. I guess that's not intuitively surprising. They were correlated to begin with, and when we got into the tail, it became even more correlated. Okay, so that's the end of kind of the mechanical side of it. We've come up with a definition which appears to be behave in fairly reasonable ways. Okay, where are we going to go with this? This is what I'm describing here. This tail covariance. Well, it's a tool. It's not an end in and of itself. It's simply a tool. It's a tool that we're going to start using fairly soon in the real job, which is the one of, say, developing these factor-based capital formulae, where we're going to have to do something to get a handle on some of these distributions, because essentially what's going to happen is that if we take tail var as our measure of capital, then it's those tail covariance terms that I was talking about that are ultimately going to drive the capital formula. Or would under the formula approximation that I described earlier, those are the things that you're going to want to try to get a handle on. So that job hasn't been done yet, but that's kind of the next thing on my agenda in terms of this particular research. There's another kind of an unresolved issue here that I said earlier. This kind of works very well for what I would call investment type risks, where the scaling the exposures doesn't change kind of what I called the shape. This theory here needs to be enhanced to deal with the fact that, you know, when you go out and sell more insurance policies, well, you get more diversification that reduces the risk, and that's not captured in the structure that I just showed you here. There is quite a bit of work done on that, but it's not nearly as nicely tidied up and with a nice little bow like we were able to do today for this one. So again, this has come to an end. We've got a tool here. I think it's a definition that I guess I think is useful. It appears to be shedding light on the practical problems that I'm working on right now. And for those of you who are either more academic persuasion, I'd very much be interested to hear what you have to say about it. Okay, thank you very much.